Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us. You are listening to Latin Waves. This is Sylvia Richardson. I am joined by documentary filmmaker and journalist, Jesse Friston. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Always a pleasure, actually, to talk to you, sir.
Wonderful. Thank you. Now, you have made, over the years, bring awareness to many issues that not only brings us back to our responsibility of connecting to the land, but also the rights of indigenous people. Tell us about your latest work.
I've been following from afar the case of the Unistoten camp and the pipeline, the various pipelines that had been trying to get through their territory for years and hadn't been able to. Basically, I showed up as somebody who'd kind of followed a little bit and then just went all in for a few weeks trying to understand the situation, and then put out a piece on the Real News Network, as well as my main reason for being there was to film for a documentary of a friend who's been working on it for a few years but who couldn't be there at the time. So yeah, that was the... So I imagine many of your listeners, certainly out on the West Coast and stuff, might be aware of the situation, but just briefly... after all this time, things came down in the Canadian courts very quickly, in the sense that TransCanada, which is the same corporation behind the Keystone XL pipeline, the North-South pipeline, and going from Canada to the U.S. that people might be familiar with, wants to build a natural gas pipeline that would take fracked natural gas from the interior of British Columbia around Dawson's Creek. So this Dawson's Creek is going to be producing natural gas, which they're trying to get to the Pacific Ocean in order to export primarily to Asia.
For many people, the idea that we're producing gas sounds benign enough. Can you talk a little bit about the process that this involved, this idea of fracking? What does it really entail, and what does it mean for the communities that face the practice in their communities?
Basically, fracking is a really kind of intense, aggressive industrial process, I would call it. Going in and liberating gas that's in rock formations below the ground using a hydraulic process, which is liquefied with pressure and a lot of chemicals. And they've actually achieved some pretty interesting victories in terms of the corporate side, in terms of not even having to release the exact ingredients of the formula that they pump into the earth, and their defense being that it's a trade secret and so that other corporations don't get to see it. But obviously, from the perspective of communities, it's kind of alarming that they don't even know what are all the chemicals that are getting pumped into their earth to release this gas. So the argument that Trudeau and others have made is that this natural gas is actually going to go replace energy-wise, in terms of, if we think of ourselves as a species on earth, it's trying to reduce our carbon emissions, that this is going to go replace coal primarily in China. Certain land defenders and other folks are saying is that this is about a decision for the future. Well, we can talk about indigenous sovereignty in a second, but just in terms of the question of energy and what kind of energy and what's clean energy and what's not, is that what the decision that needs to be made right now is about a non-fossil fuel future. And pipelines are infrastructure for fossil fuels. And this pipeline could easily be changed into an oil pipeline. One expert I talked to was showing me the application of TransCanada and showing, you know, the widths and the dimensions, and the numbers escape me right now. But basically, the argument was that they're building this pipeline in a way that it could be, as other pipelines have been in the past, changed from a natural gas pipeline to an oil pipeline. Also, once you get one pipeline through this area, this Wet'suwet'en Nation, and TransCanada made the argument in their process, in their application for the injunction, that this was the only viable route for a pipeline through the north of British Columbia. Obviously, the Rockies and the different mountain ranges make it a complex task getting a pipeline through there. So this giant valley, the Bulkley Valley, the Wet'suwet'en Yinza is a key place for them. It's 22,000 square kilometers. And so, yeah, there's a bigger question here about opening up what was called for years, industry was calling it the future energy corridor, which would be not just natural gas, but would also be oil, tar sands oil probably. And so there's a bigger struggle here for just kind of like, what kind of infrastructure are we building for the future? What are we investing billions of dollars in? And natural gas is seen as part of the infrastructure decision to continue fossil fuels.
Now, in terms of indigenous rights, and we have been, you know, there's been now decades of not just education, but awareness building about the rights of indigenous people in Canada. And in fact, in 1997, the Canadian Supreme Court had a landmark decision that declared indigenous people have rights over their lands and that they had to be consulted. Can we talk a little bit about how has this not only denied indigenous people their rights to be consulted, but is actually in violation of the Wet'suwet'en people who have never signed a treaty with Canada?
Yeah, I think this point is really key. And I think this is, if we're going to do like a media analysis, how journalism has been done around this issue, this has been a giant failure in terms of us settler journalists in particular, being able to get our heads around what sovereignty looks like and what the Wet'suwet'en governance system looks like and what that means. Because TransCanada and the government of Canada and the government of British Columbia, both worth mentioning, Horgan and Trudeau, people who are fond of talking about reconciliation, are kind of pitch themselves as part of their progressive identity, is that they are forging a new path of reconciliation. And I really think that no new path can be forged if it's not based on speaking truth. I mean, there can't be a real meaningful reconciliation unless we're really speaking truth. And we've seen these leaders kind of echoing what TransCanada's statements will say, which is that, oh, we have 20 different band councils on board, along with all these other kind of indigenous institutions. And yet they're going against like a Canadian court. So the colonial Canadian court system's own decision in 1997, which you mentioned, Delgamuukw, which is really essential for people to know when looking at the Wet'suwet'en case or any case, particularly of nations who have never signed treaties or unceded territories. Which is that this case made really three massive points came out of this case, which was that the Supreme Court of Canada declared unanimously that the Wet'suwet'en had never ceded 22,000 square kilometers. And that they said that the details of what that means needs to be worked out in further legal situations, because you do have settler municipalities that are within that 22,000 square kilometers. The towns of Houston and Smithers, for example. And so what does that mean for these municipalities if they're on unceded land? The Supreme Court said that's not up to us to decide right now. That needs to be decided in the future. But what needs to be confirmed is that territory was never ceded. And up until then, the BC government had made the argument that at the moment BC becomes part of Canada, that based on basically the doctrine of discovery, this idea that the Europeans seeing something means it's theirs, basically, means that all that territory, Kiksan, Wet'suwet'en, Coast Salish, all that territory becomes part of British Columbia and becomes part of Canada immediately. And this Supreme Court case said, no, that's not true. The second big thing that comes with that court case, which is fundamental to understanding this current situation, is that the court case says that the jurisdiction, the group that has jurisdiction over that territory, is not the Band Council, which was put in place by the Canadian government's Indian Act. The Band Council only has jurisdiction over the reservations, which certain people were forced onto during colonization. That's where the Band Council has jurisdiction. The rest of the territory is jurisdiction of the governance system that existed before colonization, which is still intact and which has continued even through residential schools, even through all these things. They still have their feast hall. They still have their chief names. This is it's certainly been disrupted, but it's never been lost governance system. And these are the people that are unanimously against the pipeline are all five clans and their chief leadership. And I got to attend and film a feast hall decision where which is where they decided when the injunction came down against them that they would, one of the other clans was going to set up a second checkpoint on their territory to make it clear that this is a national Wet'suwet'en resistance to this pipeline and not just the Unist'ot'en clan. So anyway, that was the second point. And the third point, which is also not a small point and has massive implications of Delgamuukw, was that it was the first time the Supreme Court acknowledged that oral histories were valid in court. So that was a massive case on three fronts. And it's been really kind of gross to see how bad journalists have been at understanding the implications of the second point, which is that even the Canadian courts need to recognize the hereditary chiefs as the people who have the decision on the territory and not the band councils.
Not only is this an important point to recognize, but it also is, you know, important for us to put it into context, right? Imagine if the U.S. now, you know, under Trump, decided that they just wanted to take a particular area of Canada because many of their companies are here anyways, and they feel they just have a right to access this. And in so many ways, I think we need to think of it in those terms. You know, we as a people care about a place not only because it's where we live, but it's also because the land itself defines who we are. How would the listeners, people who are, you know, perhaps do not identify themselves as settlers, but by virtue of being non, you know, Wet'suwet'en, living in Wet'suwet'en territory, you know, we all are settlers in this land. How would you invite the audience to not only take on this, you know, this challenge to speak truth, to be open to the revealing of where we stand at this point in history and what our responsibility is moving forward?
There's a complex kind of interweaving here of responsibilities and that in terms of reconciliation. The other thing I would point out is that, you know, our world's going through massive transitions beyond just the question of settler-Indigenous relations. So, you know, our economy is transforming very rapidly. There's going to have to be a transition to a new energy system and infrastructure in the near future. There's a whole bunch of transformations that are going to be taking place, whether we like it or not. And so those transitions are also opportunities to address other things. And this is why I think projects like the LEAP Manifesto are out in front on this, because they're saying, as we take on these transitions, let's try to do so in a way that also addresses, you know, some of these other horrible experiments like colonialism and tries to address some of these inequalities that we have, not just between settlers and Indigenous people, but there's other lines of identity groups and things. And so let's take that into account as we develop new infrastructures and start to, you know, use massive government investments to in green energy and things like that. Let's make sure the first people that get these new energies or whatever, so that they can be independent on their land, for example, to be the Wet'suwet'en, for example, would be an example of that. So I think though as we go into this future where things are changing rapidly and technology is changing rapidly and all these things, just to have these values and these goals out in front and to be really humble and truth-seeking and truth-speaking as we walk forward.
I'm going to play the excerpt that you recorded for The Real News. Maybe you could set it up for us.
Yeah, this is, as we were out there, we realized there was a real shortage of coverage and the timing of the injunction was right around Christmas and, or like, you know, December 19th, 20th, around then. And it was just, there was nobody publishing except for, you know, The Real News, who I've worked with in the past. They were really open to it. So I quickly edited this 7-minute piece. Yeah, I thought it was an important thing to get out at the time. It went out on December 23rd. It's probably not the best time to be trying to put out important information in North America. But yeah, this was it. And it was a bit of a call for people to get their attention on what was about to happen and what did eventually happen about a week and a half later.
Well, we're here to talk. Right,
no,
here.
Let's go back to your car. Because you guys don't have permission to come across here.
This is
we can go back over there and talk about your vehicle.
For almost a decade, the Unist'ot'en clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation have used a checkpoint to keep multiple oil and gas pipelines from being constructed on their territory in northern British Columbia.
What are you doing here?
We're just from Coastal GasLink. We're doing non-invasive testing.
Yeah, you gotta leave.
Are they safe to be here right now, though?
No, you're perfectly safe.
Okay.
Do I look like I'm trying to harm you?
No, not at
all. I'm peacefully asking you to leave because you're trespassing.
The latest such project comes from TransCanada, the same corporation behind the Keystone XL pipeline, who now wants to build a multi-billion dollar natural gas pipeline to the Pacific Ocean that would cut through hundreds of miles of unsurrendered indigenous lands. Last week, TransCanada took two prominent Wet'suwet'en leaders to court, asking for an injunction to remove the checkpoint and allow construction to begin.
It's not just this little courthouse. The whole world is watching what Canada is doing. But since I was a little girl, I was told that's our territory. They didn't tell us it belonged to somebody else, that I had to ask permission from somebody else to go on my territory. All decisions regarding territory goes through our feast hall. I didn't see no pipeline company coming into our feast hall, so they didn't follow the process, so they were the ones that messed up, not us.
Inside the courthouse, TransCanada's lawyer entered 2,400 pages of evidence. Meanwhile, the lawyer for the Unist'ot'en was only able to prepare a handful of affidavits.
And they only gave us like 2 weeks to try and prepare for this. We didn't have a lawyer until yesterday. Yeah, we've been trying to get legal advice from different people, and it's difficult because everybody's busy this time of year and the company knows it.
The courtroom filled with Wet'suwet'en chiefs and other members who watched silently for 6 hours as lawyers for both sides failed to properly pronounce the names of their clans. 24 hours later, the judge granted TransCanada an injunction ordering the opening of the gate for pipeline workers to begin construction.
I knew this was going to be a lopsided situation. You look at the federal government, they make the laws that go into the court systems, and they provided 60% of this partnership funding. So they're already right there in conflict. So it's in conflict. We're going into their courts, which they have lots to lose. So they're backing the other parties, even though everything they said were lies in their affidavits and in their application were all lies. And we had to just sit there and listen to their lies and just shake our head. That's not true. That's not what happened.
The injunction includes an enforcement order requesting the RCMP, Canada's National Police, force the gate open and, if necessary, arrest those that get in the way. Just hours before the injunction went into effect, members of the neighboring Gidimden clan installed a second checkpoint, making it impossible for TransCanada to arrive at the original checkpoint located further down the road.
Hi, my name is Bob Couture.
And we'd like to get permission to get access to go to the bridge, if we may, so I can post a notice.
Ndu Esla.
Pardon?
Ndu Esla.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Gidimden Bienka.
Are you granting us access or not?
This is Gidimden territory.
Yes.
Yes.
I understand.
You can't ask me for permission. You have to ask permission from the hereditary chiefs of the Gidimden clan.
Okay.
My name is Vic, and I'm with the Coastal GasLink project. And the reason for Mr. Couture to be here is to post the injunction that was granted by the BC Supreme Court to allow us access to do the work.
Yeah. Canadian courts do not have any jurisdiction on Wet'suwet'en territories. The Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs have full jurisdiction on Wet'suwet'en territories. We have for thousands of years, since time immemorial, we have never ceded or surrendered any of that jurisdiction. So I am not here to argue that point with you.
And we're not here to argue with you either.
Yeah,
so what we're going to do is, so we're going to post the injunction.
Thank you very much.
If physically blocked from passage, post at that location. Take a staple gun, peg and hatchet.
The hereditary chiefs held a press conference at the new checkpoint to show their support for the action. In 1997, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that the Wet'suwet'en people had never given up their rights and title to 22,000 square kilometers of northern British Columbia. and the Wet'suwet'en Hereditary Chiefs were recognized as the relevant authority on that territory.
The right and title, United Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and reconciliation, all these words have been used quite recently by governments. How do you think that reconciliation is going to be achieved when issues like this continue to arise here on the territory?
How could there be reconciliation when they won't even acknowledge who we are? No elected official at any level can outspeak the Wet'suwet'en Hereditary Chiefs. We're standing up for what the United Nations has said. Now it's time for the Prime Minister of Canada to stand up and say, we said we would uphold it, we said we would implement it, but they've done nothing but talk about it. We, as Indigenous people of this country, are the ones that need to uphold this ourselves. They need to follow what we say. We are not here to follow them.
As this report is released, helicopters are regularly flying over the two checkpoints, and it is not clear on whose land the police consider the new checkpoint to be on.
I think that everybody's quite aware of the environmental impacts of the pipeline poses. But even more than that, this is about Indigenous sovereignty. We cannot stand by and let our yinta, the land, be destroyed for all the generations to come. That would be against Wet'suwet'en law. So there's a bigger picture about the changes that are happening in the world and the changes that broader society need to recognize and need to accept.
While in court, TransCanada's lawyer argued that the only viable route for a pipeline to cross the mountain ranges of the Northwest goes through Wet'suwet'en territory. This proposed pipeline is just one of many that would carry fossil fuels extracted through fracking and tar sands development to markets in Asia and elsewhere. It might even be said that the future of this humble gate is central to the future of energy, ecology, and Indigenous sovereignty on our planet.
The oil companies love to say this number of bands have signed on to it. Many of the bans are results of colonial power that were instituted by the government, but at the same time, I think they care about their people. And when presented with either you live in this reservation with no access to any access to development of any, you know, something that builds your community, or you accept this, you know, corrosive industry that will poison your land but will give your youth a job and possibility to have money and access to buy things that you need. Many of these communities are in desperate need of access to potable water, for instance. Some of them have horrible conditions in terms of education and infrastructure. And that, I think, it's something that we need to address as a society, not as a, you know, let us poison your river and let us put a mining site on your site and then we will give you jobs and you can pay for those things. But rather thinking as a society, how do we create a place where every child truly has the right to a future, to breathe, to live, to question and be, you know, and wonder and create beautiful things with their lives. And that, I think, is where all this money that we're investing in all infrastructure for pipeline investors and people who want to frack the land. Like the whole idea of fracking, this rupturing, to me, that in and of itself, the name itself tells us something about what we're doing. You know, we're just fracturing the very weavings of what we depend on for our life. Like when you release those gases and you create those massive cracks on the rocks, you're releasing so much methane into the air, poisoning our oxygen. It's just, it's genocide. We need to not just have humility towards, but also recognize we have a responsibility. We have a responsibility to protect and to leave the land, if not improve, because we have created a lot of damage, at least, you know, as we found it, you know, at least well enough so that future generations have a chance. There's so many ways that we can enrich our society by creating what we need, you know, and not just doing what we've always done. And it's not about demonizing the people who work in these industries out of the necessity to have a paycheck and, you know, be able to feed their families. It's about recognizing that as a society, we need to shift and adapt, you know, to the facts of climate change, to the fact that our oceans are heating up, to the fact that our forests are our source of life. There, we need those trees. We need that land to be left untouched. We need those gases to be left where they are so we don't poison ourselves. And it really is about self-survival more than anything else. And I think that we can't survive without having a sense of rightness about the way we go about creating our way of being in this world. And that means respecting other people, respecting indigenous rights, respecting the rights of the land, respecting, you know, the rights of every child to have a future.
Yeah, we need really, really powerful acts of imagination as well. And I think that would benefit a lot from allowing cultures to thrive, allowing the Wet'suwet'en Feast Hall to be a place of governance over its territory and not interfering in it so aggressively and letting Wet'suwet'en people with all their knowledge of past and present and their focus on the future to work instead of having to spend so much of their time and energy just trying to participate in the Canadian legal system and defend their sovereignty and get child welfare out of their communities and sort of this, instead of all that being able to focus on developing solutions to their problems, the same problems in terms of how are we going to heat our homes and stuff. They have those problems as well. So, I mean, it's like, I think this is key.
I wanted, we're coming to the end of our show, and I want to perhaps also celebrate the Wet'suwet'en people because, you know, most of us from Avia Yala, and that's what colonial power calls Latin America, recognize that this struggle is alive throughout the Americas. It's you know, it's not just in Turtle Island, it's all over. But every time a people, you know, and in this case I would say to stand for the land, it's almost like a spark of hope is lit up, right? Because not only it reminds us, those who sometimes grow too tired to take notice, but it sparks in us a call to remember that we are part of the land and we are, you know, shaped and, you know, formed by it. So it is a privilege to be on the land. It is a privilege to be a guest on this unceded territory. It is a privilege to be, you know, participating of the beauty and the wonders that this land offers. And it's also a responsibility to take notice and to participate in also protecting and respecting the rights and the voices of the people who are the, you know, rightful owners and inheritors of this land.
Yeah, I think there's something that a lot of us have lost in the modern age, if we can call it that or whatever, is to have these kind of like built-in rituals in our life where we remind ourselves regularly to suppress our ego and remember that we're just a small part of something much bigger.
Thank you so much for being with us. How can people access your work?
I have a website. It's jessefreeston.com, jessefreeston.com.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com.